Simoniello?
Yeah, Rosa Simoniello, sir. So the last topic that you have touched on, slide 63, so deals a very nice reduction of the pileup with the crab kissing. So if you expand a bit more, because it was kind of fast, so how actually it works always with this tilt of the beam?
Let's go fast in this way. Toward the end. Here it is.
Yes. So how you manage to get...
So basically, take the beam. The idea is this one. Take the beam, the two bunch, so two cylinder, they go like this. Then we do a crossing angle. And with the crab cavity is an exercise. Take, for example, CMS, where horizontal, there is the horizontal crossing. So the two beam that should cross in this way, they are... kick it transversely, and we do this way, such a way that they cross exactly like this. And then they are taken back. So, with the crab cavity, we can also use half of the crab cavity to do this gymnastic. The other way is to do, look at this. We call kissing because we do like this with the beam. At this point, the two beam compenetrates, basically they cross in zero time, because you have to realize the two beam, when they cross in this way, there is a time where they cross. In this way, basically they cross in zero time, but the region where they cross is extended. Because even if we do this way, a certain point, you have always a little bit of angle, it takes always time. I mean, the real crossing point, it takes time, and it is shorter, the crossing distance. If you do like this, they cross each other, they are too close, they cross each other at the same time, but the length where it is crossed is short, elongated. So you see the two beams, one beam like this, one beam like this. So we use half of the, suppose that we have four cavity per side, two cavity we use to move with the crossing angle, and the other to do this crab kissing scheme. It's quite complicated, it's not yet proven, was published by the guy Stefan Fartuk that invented this. We have still to prove it will be along. It's not at the baseline of the project. It's not at the baseline of the project, but we are working and we hope in a few years to have a baseline. It's not only the crab, it's not only the crab cavity that we give us this, but also the fact that we think, yet it's not in the baseline of the project, so we are not sure, but we are discussing if to install a second harmonic system, a RF harmonic system, in the accelerator that helps to stretch the bunch length. Because basically, if you have an RF system, you can only, you have only a certain length of the beam, because you can use only few RF. But with the second harmonic, faster, basically you can either make it shorter or longer the beam. So this is the trick. But this is really something new. It's been taught really 2 years ago, and it's something never tested in a collider. It can be used, maybe, I guess, also in an electro collider, if it is useful.
Thank you.
Just to complete the question, what is the concept of the crab waist cavities?
It's different. The crab waist that was devised by Pantaleo in Frascati is different. Basically, it has to do with the fact that with some special sensible, you change the shape of the beam. In LEC, it's not to say they change the shape of the beam at the collision point. Because you have to realize that when you realize a beta star very small, so the beta star is huge in the magnet. That means the beam is huge in the IR magnet to make them focus in Atlas or in CMS or in the crossing point. So you have always to go, it's optics. You have a fixed distance. If here is more focus, means going back in the magnet is bigger. So it's more focus here, but the fact that the beta star so varies between, for example, the LEC now, 4 kilometers in the triplet and 60 centimeters in the experiment. In the IHLAC will vary between 16 kilometers, the beta star, the beta in the triplet, and only 10 centimeters, 15 here. That means the beta star varies. The point that the bunch has a certain length, If the variation of the beta star, the typical length, is shorter than the bunch, it means that the bunch itself will have different beta star inside the bunch. In other way, the bunch itself will not be anymore a cylinder, will be kind of a, how to say, clepsydra in English. Sorry. Clepsydra. Hourglass, sorry. I have only been, it's really the shape of hourglass. This idea of Pantaleo counteracts this. It makes flat the beam and counteracts this. In LAC, we are at the limit, but we don't see a lot of hourglass effect, so we will not apply the crab weight. This is typically used in electro machine. In fact, it's a great idea for Super B, for this type of machine. I think they will apply, if they do the Chinese lepton collider, for example, they will apply this, or the TLEP, or it will be applied.
Savitsky?
Well, in 2013, during ATV LHC, the physics community got unexpected proton lead run after the lead run. Is there any chance to get similar run during the high Lumi LHC? And if no, what are the obstacles and so on?
To have lead during high luminosity? This is the question.
Is there a possibility to get nucleons-related runs during the high-luminosity LHC?
Yes, it is for a thing to have lead, or let's say lead proton, at least up to the LS4. Let's get the right slide. Just a second. Which I see a little bit better. This one. Okay. So here you see we have to plan in 20-30 years ahead. So in LS2, both Alice and LACB will do major upgrade. In fact, this is a little bit older now. LS2 will be moved and longer, but okay, the idea is this one. Then Alice will continue to take data, certainly up to LS4, that now LS4 is moved to 2030. Yeah? We'll take data up to that one. Then it's not clear if they take data, because of course, certainly we'll take data up to here, because this is fluorescein and so on. If you're able to give to Alice the performance that we promised, probably they will stop. They asked kind of... I don't remember exactly the performance, 10, I think, microbar inverse, at lead plus 3 at lower field. They need to for them it's very important to change the magnetic field of the spectrometer to have exact calibration. If you are able to give the performance up to LS4, that I repeat, it will be moved here now, probably they will be happy, they will stop. If you are not able to give the performance of integrated luminosity, because do not forget, integrated luminosity is always the product of a certain luminosity times a certain time, a certain duration time. If you will be lower in performance, because they are asking a lot in terms of peak luminosity for the LED, maybe we need to continue to collect data up to LS5. Then hopefully they will not get any more data because of course demand for the ions is not nice to say like this, but it's subtracted to the proton-proton luminosity. So if we are here, and here really we are dominated by statistics, and we need to go on and to collect data, in order to continue to make Atlas, LAC, Atlas CMS, and LACB interesting, we need to have time. The proton is taking, the lead is taking approximately 15% of the time, because it is true it's only 1 month. But it's 1 month at the end of the run, where usually the machine is well set, and usually Atlas and CMS and LACB, they pay the tip of setting up the machine. And then it is true, the IR run is not that long, it's 3 weeks, 3-4 weeks, but usually it's 3-4 weeks very clean. This is clear. So there is certain pressure from the big experiment to not to continue to go on like this. This is highly politically, so I can tell you that up to LS4 we will go on and then let's see what's happened. I will be long time in retired after this. So some people have to fight. I hope he's not satisfied with the answer.
Well, honestly, I expected that there can be some obstacles with pile up and so on when you are running on the during the high luminosity.
Why obstacle?
I mean that the high luminosity setup of the collider, right, or like a detector setup, can be incompatible with the high track presence during collision of different ions and so on.
But I do not understand. I mean, we do not touch the optics in point two, where there is ALIS, for example. And do not forget, when you run ions, it is compatible with the setup. For example, when we run ions, actually it's not only ALIS taking data, it's also ATLAS and CMS. CMS, for example, is a very big community of AV ions. So it's perfectly compatible when we do ions that is compatible with iluminosity, perfectly compatible with ions. It's not a problem from this point of view. I don't know if I answer your question.
Well, it's good to hear. Actually, I didn't expect that such run even will exist, because usually people are stretched on the proton-proton program and so on.
No. The ions is fully part of the CERN. Actually, there is competition. Everybody would like that the ears has a little bit more days, but okay, in order to accommodate all the clients. But no. It's fully compatible with lead, even if with oxygen, even if with other strange species. The optics is compatible.
Okay, there is a comment from Professor Tannenbaum.
I just had a comment about the high luminosity lead. It seemed to me, I'm remembering, this is all when we did this stuff, it was like 20 years ago. Isn't the luminosity limited by electron positron pair production? Lead plus lead goes to lead plus E plus E minus, which at Rick, the cross section is 27 kilobarns for that. And then electron gets captured on the lead nucleus and you lose it.
Okay.
Isn't that the limitation?
We might be limited by this effect that you say that creates some, ions going into the magnet. But for this one, we are working on improving the collimation. Actually, the first 11 tesla dipole, that means collimation in the cold region, is forcing to go to ALIS. It's not sure that we need, but we are preparing for this, actually for ALIS, exactly in order not to limit. Then eventually, in reality, is limited by ALIS itself. I can tell you that we discovered in the discussion with the experiment, because it's nice, discussing with the experiment, I set up a coordination group with the experiment, we discovered that the experiments sometimes they don't talk too much to each other, which is normal, of course, and we discovered, to our surprise, the machine, actually, who today is collecting more ion collision is CMS, is not ALIS. CMS is working at CMS and ATLAS at double peak luminosity than ALIS. That's why ALIS they want to upgrade and to have much faster collection day. Of course, ALIS is specialized. They see very well. They have the time of flight and so on. But in terms of peak luminosity, ATLAS and CMS are better equipped than ALIS. So they're collecting more, they're burning more ions than in ALIS.
Bello?
Thank you. Pavel Belov.
Where you are?
It's
okay,
me.
Good.
Pavel Belov, St. Petersburg State University. So I have two questions. The first one, when you tell about luminosity, do you mean stored or delivered luminosity? And if...
Okay.
How do you measure or calculate delivered luminosity? Just by formula which you provide
Okay, let's answer to this question. Yeah. First of all, how we measure luminosity? We have a system, we discovered that the best is just to rely on the luminosity measurement by the experiment, which are certainly the most accurate in measure, because they need, of course, to know very well. Having said this, we have also other parameters. You have seen the luminosity, how depends from many parameters. Since we measure a single parameter with a certain inaccuracy, we are able to determine what is the luminosity, at least at the beginning. And then we have other means to control the proton burning, the decreasing intensity of the beam, and so on. But the best measurement is coming from the experiment itself. What is the difference? In the luminosity we always tell is the luminosity that we deliver to the experiment. Not that in reality the experiment are typically, maybe Peter can correct me, is typically the difference between the luminosity that we deliver and the luminosity recorded, the usual luminosity, is of the order of 5-10%, let's say. For example, in 2012 we have delivered 25 inverse centobar. I think the sperm record a kind of 22, something like this. So maybe, but Peter can comment more. This is what I recollect, I remember.
Yeah, just to comment on that, I actually showed a slide that we typically, talking about CMS and Atlas, we record about 95% of the delivered luminosity when the machine is declared stable, and then come still the data preparation part where one checks that really the quality of the data is perfect, and the end result is that typically 90% of the stably delivered luminosity goes into the physics plots, which actually is very remarkable if one compares to previous to experiments. Maybe I can also just comment that, as Lucio says, the most precise determination of the luminosity comes indeed from the experiments with quite a lot of work. It's typically in the order of 2 to 3 percent, the precision of the measured luminosity. And it uses actually a very old method, which was invented by Van der Meer at the ISR, to determine the overlap area of the beam by running at low luminosity, but sweeping the beams across each other and determining essentially the effective overlap of the beams.
Thanks, Peter. The Van der Meer scan before each run. You have the second question?
Yeah, and the second question, you emphasized that the helium temperature is 1.9 Kelvin. Could you repeat why, and why not 1 Kelvin or 3 Kelvin, because the temperature of boiling is about 4 Kelvins?
So, most of the magnet and all the other previous accelerator, Tevatron, Rick and so on, work at 4.2 Kelvin, 4.5, which is the normal liquid helium boiling temperature at normal pressure, let's say. So why we are using 1.9, 1.8? It's because the niobium titanium, the material that we are using, it improves its superconducting properties going down in temperature. We have to understand that superconductivity is a gift of God or whatever, a gift of somebody, because it is a shortcut of a property that in principle should appear at zero Kelvin. It's kind of a shortcut. More, and is a basically is a transition phase where it counts three parameters: temperature, as any thermodynamic system, intensive properties is the magnetic field, and extensive property is the current. So magnetic field plays the role of pressure, and current plays the role of volume, let's say, in a thermodynamic system. And you have to below a certain critical surface. That means if you decrease the temperature, you have more room to have more field and more current. If you increase, when you are at critical temperature, means the material does the transition at zero field and zero current. So basically, when you move, for example, the critical temperature of niobium titanium is 9 Kelvin. But at 9 Kelvin, it just becomes barely superconductor. You have no possibility to send a lot of current, a lot of field, and to have high field. More going down in temperature, you increase the room, and you can transform, really, the margin in current and in field. Let's put it this way. So, niobium titanium is very sensitive to this, and practically, going down in temperature from 4 Kelvin to 1.8, 1.9, basically, you can have, basically, 2 Tesla more. Our magnet would be limited to probably, okay, we can make the example. SSC, that was very pushy, the SSC, the superconducting machine of the United States, the super superconducting collider was cited by Peter Yenny and by the question of Tannenbaum, was working at 4.2 Kelvin and was pushing the magnet at the maximum, and the magnet were set for 6.6 Tesla. It was already very pushy. Maybe more pushy than our 8.3 Tesla. So it's 1.8 Tesla different. So that means, in translating in energy, we can have 1.2 TV per beam more in the LHC. That means we gain 2.5 TV center of mass. is not enormous, but it's something that is worth to do. So that's why. That's why we go to superfluid helium. Why don't we go down? Well, because most of the gain, when you are at 1.8, most of the gain is there, 1.8. And then to push more, of course, you are fighting against thermodynamics. The capability to take out entropy decreases. It becomes more and more difficult. You can go to 1.4 with a tremendous effort. You have to spend a lot more, let's put it this way. There is also a third reason, which is the superfluid helium is superfluid. It's like superconductivity. Not for nothing we use electrical superconductivity and mechanical superconductivity, which is called superfluidity, which is zero mechanical friction. And actually, the superfluid helium is actually a mixture of you can see, like superconductivity, you can describe it as a mixture of a real absolute superfluid component plus a resistive component, mechanical resistive in this case. It turned out that because of this, you have the best heat transfer of superfluid helium. The capability to transfer heat of superfluid helium is maximum at around 1.8, 1.9. So thermically, it's even better to stay 1.8, 1.9 Kelvin respect to go to 1.4. I remind you that the transition is 2.17 Kelvin, the lambda point, the transition to superfluidity. So there is a lot of principle and a lot of technical reason to stay around this temperature. Is it fine?
Yeah, thank you.
Campbell? Hi, Sarah Campbell, Columbia University.
Hello. Ah, good. Okay.
I have two questions, and they're both about the collimation system.
Yes?
You mentioned this briefly before. Uh-oh. The first question is, when it goes through the primary collimator and you create this shower, what prevents those particles in the shower from traveling further down the beam pipe and adding to your halo later on?
Just a second. I tried to catch the... the picture of the collimator. Here it is. I think it's this one.
Yeah.
Yes. What prevents this particle to go along this one?
Right.
Well, this particle also are going along the beam chamber, but do not forget, particle will never do exactly like this. They have always a divergence, always. I mean, the probability that the particle is perfectly aligned is almost zero. This I can make sure. That means eventually either it goes off and it will be catched. Actually, we don't have collimation only one point of the machine. We have collimation in 2 points of the machine. And do never forget, the beam oscillates. Let me do only a parenthesis, because for the beginning, since you will hear as a particle physicist a lot interacting with the machine physicist about the beta. What is the beta? It's the fact that the beam oscillates. And the beta is the beam oscillates because there are convergent lenses, which are the quadrupole. And any lenses, it has a focal, stronger the length and shorter is the focal length. The beta is the focal length. That's why in the experiment, the beta is very small because it's strongly focused, the beam. So, going back. So, there is, the beam oscillates, and sooner or later, it will be catched by another collimation system. Sooner or later. When it is in the hull of the beam, there's no hope that it stays stable here. Because even if it goes there, it has a diversion, and it will go up and will be catched by the collimator on the other side. Here, there is the axis. So, this collimator, there are also on the other side. So it will be trapped there. Is it satisfactory, the question? More or less. Is the question of dynamics. There is, in fact, a long, long tracking to understand where the particle goes. And eventually, some particle, they goes on the magnet. Some particle, they goes on the magnet. But it's only 1/10,000 or 1/100,000.
So that gets... I don't know if you want to speak first, but
please.
I have a second question.
Maybe Peter wants to add. Just a second, Peter.
Yeah, I just want to add. This is, of course, all correct what you say, but in addition, these particles have lower momenta, so they are swept into the collimators which come afterwards.
Forgot.
Momentum is lower, so they...
Momentum is lower. The first dipole will swept. Like the first dipole will swept.
Yeah, they sweep.
Yeah, sure. I forgot this point. Absolutely, you're right.
I'm sorry, can I come in here? But for example, in the case of the CMS, there was a castor experiment which were...
Excuse me, I've not understood. There is this noise which is there.
Oh, okay, I'm just wondering, I want to comment that, for example, in the CMS case, there was a castor experiment which was using muons, for example, for the calibration. It was using Hell muons, which were born at the first collimator, which is closest to the CMS. And actually, this can also be, can happen in this case, that those Hall muons will move towards the Hall, towards the beam direction. And
towards the experiment, you mean?
Yes.
Yeah, this is part of the background. Some particles are inevitably part of the background. In fact, we do a lot of calculation for this. It is true. Some can eventually go to... You never can shield perfectly. These are proton 70 V energy. So eventually it will be done. It can be also much more a dangerous thing, but... For example, we couldn't avoid the splash in Alice at certain point, seems to me, because there is the injection there, and despite the fact that you have many absorbers, some particle can leak. But maybe you said you had a second question.
Yeah, my second question is about the absorber. What do you use to absorb that much energy, and what will work in your new higher luminosity, higher energy plans?
This is a good point. In fact, the primary collimation are never heavy metal because they will absorb too much and they will be destroyed. In fact, the primary and also the secondary, the primary collimator is basically graphite, light element. We want to spread, let's say, the particle. And this one is a mixture, is graphite and carbon. And now we want to have also, by the way, we want to put with copper because, of course, graphite has a lot of resistance. So the beam sees resistance. And eventually, the absorber you see here is copper and tungsten. And in high luminosity, we want to do it all in tungsten, the fine absorber. At the end, but here, you know, you have to think these things are also long. We have many, and each one is 71 meter long. We have many, so we try to spread. It's the only strategy. There is also another strategy I've not shown here. We are testing new type of collimation, for example, using special crystal channeling, where the proton can channeling. If it works, it's very good. Of course, it's a little bit dangerous, because if something goes wrong, then you have the TV beam. But this would be very nice. And in fact, in the channeling, the crystal collimation, the real key point is the absorber, because suppose that here, instead of a primary collimator, you put something that takes all this green beam and puts here. But then we need to have an absorber that is capable to absorb in a short, is the real problem. So absorber is really point. Do not forget that the dump of the LAC, the one that is under the airport that was shown by Peter Yenny, is really a huge system basically done of iron and concrete. I mean, the energy of the LAC. And there are special magnets that dilute the beam. Because otherwise, if we simply throw away the beam will continue to perforate and eventually will go up, I don't know where, in some region, some nice valley of Switzerland, and Peter will not be happy. But there's no way. It's so dense, the beam, that you need to spread. The only strategy is to spread the energy in order to avoid continuous perforation of the... Because otherwise, concrete, copper, or tungsten, whatever you put, the simple beam will perforate.
I'm sorry, can I ask again?
Yeah, sure.
Once I was asked similar question, where actually LHC dumps and the beam, and it was like really interesting because usually you cannot find this information so easily. But what happens when the beam starts to hit the storage where the beam is dumped? I mean, what happens with the heat? It won't warm up the airport, right?
No, it doesn't warm up because, in fact, we don't have simply kicker that take out the beam. We have the kicker that take out the beam, and we have special kicker that we call dilution kicker, that they spread the beam in such a way that a bunch goes here, the other bunch goes there, the other bunch goes there, and so on. The 3,000 bunch, 1,500 bunch so far, 3,000 in the future, they are spread over a wide volume, wide surface, exactly to avoid. We believe in electromagnetism, not only because Professor Van Top fixed it, but really it works. So it's a problem. If we, without dilution kicker, we cannot operate the LAC for question of radio protection. Because there is a risk. It's part of the safety system of the LAC. So it's safe, don't worry, but it is true, it's a critical point. It's a critical point. And I repeat, it's a huge gallery where we lose the beam, we put long, but also spread in surface.
Okay, we ran out of time, and we also finished the question, so I'm afraid that we have to...
Yeah, sure.
Sure.
Thanks.
And